and welcome to Catholic Answers Focus. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and delighted to be with you again this week. We have a very special guest this week. Rod Dreher is the senior editor at the American Conservative, and he gained wide attention with his book Crunchy Cons, a book that extolled the lives of countercultural, sometimes Birkenstock-wearing conservatives. And his newest book is The Benedict Option, taking its name from an idea that Rod has been exploring for several years now. Not an uncontroversial idea, but nonetheless a very important idea because it is so widely discussed. The one thing that almost everyone seems to agree on today, while we agree on little else, is that there's something deeply and even frighteningly wrong with the state of American society and the Western world in general. The Benedict Option is a diagnosis of the problem to some degree, and is also a solve for the problem, or a suggestion of how we may respond to what has gone wrong in the world today. Rod Dreher, thanks so much for being with us on Catholic Answers Focus.
Sorry, thanks so much for having me.
Now, before we get into what the cure is, or the proposed cure, I suppose, or part of the proposed cure in the Benedict Option, what if you had to say what is wrong, what has gone wrong with our society, our culture?
Well, to put it in short, we've supplanted God with ourselves. In other words, even though we say that we're worshiping God, in fact, we tend to worship ourselves and our own preferences. And this has been something that's been building for a long, long time in our culture, for centuries even. But it has finally reached the point where it has, in American life at least, supplanted authentic Christianity. And it's not just me saying that. It's sociologist Christian Smith at Notre Dame has called this sort of thing moralistic therapeutic deism. He said it's a pseudo-Christianity, a feel-good Christianity that has infiltrated and taken over most expressions of Christianity in the United States. This is what we have to fight against.
And I suppose Walker Percy had the idea years ago that we were experiencing the rise of mass culture, and that it had enormously destructive effects. Do you think we have been shallowed out or hollowed out by pop culture and mass media? Or
oh, we absolutely have, and the church has not provided an adequate pushback against it. I mean, we are catechized 24/7 by this post-Christian culture, by an anti-Christian culture that tells us whatever we desire must be true by the simple fact that we desire it. And the church, when I say the church, I mean not just the Roman Catholic Church, but the Protestant churches and the Orthodox Church. We really have yet to come to terms with modernity and providing a powerful countercultural story. One of the inspirations for my book, Cy, was an essay that the Catholic historian Robert Louis Wilkin wrote in First Things back in 2004, where he said that we in the West are forgetting our Christian story, and there's nothing more important right now for Christians in the West than to tell ourselves our own story before we forget it. That is what I advocate in the Benedict Option. It's not a head-for-the-hills withdrawal, but it is saying that we have to do a strategic withdrawal now to deepen our catechesis, to deepen our prayer lives, to strengthen our ties to each other and to the historical church, so when we go out into the world to evangelize and bear witness for the faith, we actually have something to tell people, something real, something life-giving, something countercultural, because we can't give people what we don't have. And if you look at the studies and the statistics, we don't have the authentic faith.
Would it be fair to say that your kind of understanding of where the Christian churches are now, and you use the lowercase orthodox to kind of, and it seems to me that's a reasonable use, to kind of connect whether it's Protestants or uppercase Orthodox Catholics across the world or across the Western culture who have not forgotten the person of Christ and still hold on to these the Christian values, the Christian story. So together, that group is very similar to one another in that kind of, I suppose, resistance to the
sure.
So you use that term. Now, would it be fair to say that part of what undergirds the whole idea of the Benedict option is an idea that perhaps since the sexual revolution, 1967, if we just put a date on it, that there's been a massive catechesis in the world about human sexuality, just as an example. And the church has a formation problem. We're not able to form our own children. We're not able to form our own married couples, our own adults. And that the Benedict option is at least a proposal for as a solution to our formation problem, given the pressures of the modern world.
Boy, that is such an important point. As most of your listeners may know, or some of them may know, I was a Catholic convert in my early 20s. And was Catholic for 13 years. I remember when I came into the church at the age of 25, one of the things I had to repent of, the main thing I had to repent of, was sexual sin. And I committed myself to chastity as a Catholic, but it was a pretty lonely fight because I didn't feel like I had the church at my back. I had Pope John Paul at my back, and I was so thankful to God for his writing. But at the local church, I didn't feel that.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, I knew what was expected of me, and I did it. And thank God for it. That period of asceticism, the 3 years before I met the woman I was to be married to, really changed me and helped heal a lot of the brokenness inside me. And I was able to see how liberating the Catholic Church's teachings on sexuality were. But I can remember sitting in my apartment in Brooklyn a few years later, me and my wife and some friends of ours, complaining with our Catholic friends about how awful catechesis was in the parish, how awful the sermons were, how the bishops weren't on top of this, and on and on and on. One of our friends who was sitting there is a Catholic priest of the Diocese of Brooklyn, and he said, "You know, guys, everything you're saying is true. We're failing as an institution to teach our kids. But let me tell you what, you guys are part of the church too. You can go online tonight and order from Amazon.com a library that would have made Aquinas blush. He couldn't have dreamed of it. And you can have it delivered to your front door. You can set up groups within your parish. You can come together. You can teach each other. You can teach your children. Don't sit around and wait on the institution to get this act together. Act as a church yourself." And we listened to Father Wilson say this, and I thought, oh man, he's right. But don't you know, we're back to complaining about the failures of the institutional church. So it's so typical. What I want to say, though, is that, yeah, the church, the institutional church, is doing a poor job in most places with forming adults and forming children. But that is no excuse for the laity not to step in and act as a church in that way. The church has given us the catechism. The church has given us so much. We just have to take it and go with it and do these things and not just sit around and talk about it.
And okay, so but your strategy then, please correct me if I misunderstand, because I really want to understand the Benedict option. It seems to me that it is a strategy. It's a proposal of a strategy, and it is that if we are to form people in Christ, young people, old people, but families, the whole deal in Christ, we've got to do something more radical than what we've been doing. And that radical thing does, in fact, involve not withdrawal, maybe that's the wrong word, but a kind of commitment to build up small communities in which that formation can take place.
That's exactly right. And the reason I say it has to be radical is because the culture around us has become so toxic and so overwhelmingly anti-Christian that the only way that Christian individuals and Christian families can live within it without being assimilated to it is to form these cells of resistance. And I use the sort of revolutionary language deliberately, because the cell of resistance ought to be the parish, ought to be Christian schools, ought to be the family. And what it's going to take is not just to go along to get along Christianity, where our faith is part of our lives. We have to do like the Benedictine monks and make the faith our life, period. Order everything in our lives to serving Christ. That, to me, is the biggest lesson that Christians in the world, lay Christians, can take from the cloistered monks. we're not called to live in monasteries or head for the hills and build compounds. I think most of us will be called to live in the world. But that means that we have to arrange our daily lives in such a way that everything we do is centered around serving Christ and living in harmony with God's will. And it takes little simple things, too, like turning the TV off, maybe getting TV out of your family's life, or being a lot more deliberate about what you watch. Maybe it depends. You will be called to start a classical Christian school, or there are all kinds of things we can do, everyday things that form our identities more strongly in the faith. Because I tell you, people who think that they've got it covered by just going to Mass on Sunday, maybe sending their kids to Catholic school and thinking that's going to be enough, it's not going to be enough. We can see this happening right now, not only in the Catholic Church, but in Protestant churches, in every church. The culture is just too strong for us to do what we've been doing for all these many years.
It seems to me that the categories of critique or criticism of the Benedict option, there's two primary. One is those who will say you're too hard on modernity. That strikes me as implausible. Maybe a Pollyannism of some kind. It is really as bad as Rod says it is. The other is that not that you're too hard on modernity, but that this idea of withdrawing into these communities is in some way unhealthy or unhelpful. How do you respond to those critiques?
Well, the Pollyanna thing is so easy to knock down. I mean, some people say, Rod, you're being alarmist. And I say, well, yeah, because there's a lot to be alarmed about in this culture. I mean, look, we've just destroyed marriage over the last 50 years. Heterosexuals did a great job at that. And now we have gay marriage. And now we're destroying the idea of gender in our public life. But you look at the statistics of people falling away from the church, and it's just breathtaking what's happening. Pope Benedict himself said that the West is going through a time of spiritual malaise and trial worse than any since the fall of Rome,
right,
which is what produced St. Benedict. So people who say that it's not as bad as all that, they're either not paying attention or they're afraid to see what's really going on, because that means they'll have to change in ways they don't want to. The second one is harder to contend with, the idea that it's unhealthy to withdraw. I try to deal with this in the book side by talking to some people who have had bad experiences with intense community. I talked to this one young woman. I didn't use her real name. She was raised by Catholic parents who retreated to a rural area to raise the family, to get them away from all the impurities of the world. And she said that the faith they raised them with was mostly fear-based, that there was a threat around every corner, that 3 days of darkness were going to come any moment now. And this girl said that when each one of her siblings, including herself, hit 18, they ran as far away from the church as they possibly could. And that really shook me up to hear that. I know it's true because I've heard similar things from Protestant kids raised in fundamentalist backgrounds. That wasn't my experience at all growing up in a small town in the Deep South. In fact, I longed for a deeper commitment to the faith and for more rigor, more spiritual discipline. But I have to take seriously the stories of people who have been damaged by too much of that. When I was in Norcia, where the St. Benedict is from and where they have a Benedictine monastery, I was there last year spending time with those monks and talking to them about staying away, leaving the world. And they said, look, we have so many pilgrims here, and mostly the monks are cloistered. They spend most of their time behind the walls, saying their prayers, studying scripture, working, and so on. But one of the monks told me the only way we can be for these pilgrims who come here, who Christ asked us to be, is if we spend that time behind the walls in contemplation. And the same is true. It's kind of a spiritual law for the laity as well. I mean, remember, Christ went to the desert before he started his ministry. In a similar way, if we are going to be for the world and live in the world as faithful Christians and bear witness to Christ, we're going to have to separate ourselves in some way for a period of time from the world, or we're going to be swallowed up by it. I think about the example, Cy, of Jeremiah 29, when God, speaking through the prophet Jeremiah to the Israelites held captive in Babylon, he told them, I brought you here for a reason. You're exiles, but stay there, plant yourselves, pray for the peace and prosperity of the city. However, when it came down for the men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the three Hebrews who worked for the king, when the king asked them, King Nebuchadnezzar, to bow down before an idol he constructed, they said, King, you're going to have to kill us first. We will not betray the Lord. And so he threw them into the furnace, for they were not consumed. My point in the Benedict option is, yes, we are called to live in the world, most of us, as the Israelites in exile were, but we have got to do whatever we possibly can to strengthen ourselves internally so that if and when we are asked to do the modern equivalent of bowing before the golden idol, we have the strength of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to say, no, we'll be martyrs first.
And you use the word intense community, and that does seem to be at the heart of the Benedict option, this idea of these intense communities. And I think pretty much the whole second half of the book is about kind of ideas on how to live out the Benedictine values in a really truly kind of Christian postmodern world, to live them out. What strike you as the best ideas?
Well, I'll tell you, the best community that I found in traveling around meeting different Christian communities was this Catholic community in a seaside city called San Benedetto del Tronto. They're affiliated with the monastery in Norcia. There are about 150 people there. They call themselves the Tippi Loschi, which means the usual suspects. That gives you an idea of how lighthearted they are. But they're very Orthodox in their Catholicism. But they're also very joyful. I spent some time with them. They started a classical Christian school within their community, which is a terrific idea. But they also started some co-ops to help people coming out of prison who need work. They're serving the poor that way. They get together every week at their sort of clubhouse there on a hill overlooking the Adriatic to have mass. They have at least one communal meal together a week. And mind you, they all live in apartments throughout the city doing normal jobs, but they come together for Bible study, both adult and with the kids. They know their faith. They're doing communal gardening. They're doing all kinds of things to build up their community, root it firmly in the Catholic faith, but also to spread it, because they welcome anybody to that community. And you know what, Cy? They're doing it with joy. That is the most attractive thing about these folks. They know what they believe. They're faithful Orthodox Catholics, and they're not angry about it. I tell you, you go there, you want to stay forever, because this is what the church is supposed to be. I mean, not just the Catholic Church, but every church is supposed to be these joyful Christians who are rooted firmly in the faith, who want to know more about their faith, both in terms of catechesis and putting their faith into action, and who are doing so with a spirit of feasting.
It has, if I may say, the way you talk about it has a slightly romantic sound, though, Rod. And I just want to press you on that a little bit. I mean, you know, live on an Italian hillside over the Adriatic and all that. Is this an idea that's applicable to, the metropolis of the modern world, or the suburban kind of sprawl of the modern world?
Well, it has to be, and I don't want to paint a false picture. This town, San Benedetto del Tronto, is not a romantic Italian hillside town. It looks like it was mostly constructed right after the war, a lot of modern buildings. If you want to go live in a really beautiful Italian city, you can go other places. But in talking to Marco Sermarini, who is the unofficial leader of the group, he's a lawyer in that town, you know, I said to him, how are you going to keep your kids here in this small city when there's so much opportunity elsewhere? He said, you know, to be honest with you, in Italy today, if you want to make it big in the world, you have to go to Rome. You have to go to Milan or one of the bigger cities. He said, all we can do here in our little town is show our kids what it means to live as a Catholic community, enjoy in service of the Lord and as families. And we have to hope that they will choose that. I think what I took from that, I mean, I live in the city of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which not the most beautiful city you've ever seen, but it looks like most American cities. But there's no reason why we can't live like that here if we have the desire to do it. The Tipolowski didn't start overnight. It started with some guys who got really serious about their Catholic faith and very intentional back when they were in college. And they stayed together afterwards doing service projects for the poor. They brought their girlfriends, later their wives, into it. And they just built this community slowly, slowly, slowly over the years. To me, that is a real sign of hope. The idea that, you know, we don't live in Italy. We don't have the resources they have, but we also have some resources they may not have. We have got to be able to take those ideas and that inspiration, plant them in our own soil where we are, whether it's in the suburbs, small town America, or the big city, and try to make something work. This book of mine, The Benedict Option, it's not a book of solutions, but what I hope it is, it's a book where I'm showing what some Christians, Italy, elsewhere in America, and so on, some things they're trying to live more authentically Christian lives in a post-Christian society. And maybe others will get some inspiration from that and be what Pope Benedict asked us all to be and said we all would have to be in this day and age, creative minorities. There's no one formula for all of us. But we do know that we have to experiment to come up with a way to hold on to the true faith in this time of great trial. And fortunately, there are Christians all over the world who are trying to do this right now and who have some wisdom to share with us.
Indeed, it seems that there are, I'm thinking of Archbishop Chaput's book on living in a post-Christian or being Christian in a post-Christian world. I think, is it Strangers in a Strange Land?
Strangers in a Strange Land. It's a great book.
Yeah, and there are others of a similar ilk. It does seem to me that the attention of those who are leaders and thinkers and writers in the Christian world is turned towards, okay, how it's not going to come back. You know, it's not a storm that's going to pass. So how are we going to do this now? It feels like a kind of, frankly, a giving up. And I would imagine you would say, and I don't think I would be reluctant to agree with you, it's the giving up of a false hope that this storm was ever going to pass and things would become normal again. And it seems that like there is this kind of, acknowledgement, no, this is not coming back. And now there's very serious thought going into now, how do we go on now? How do we live the Great Commission now, given that? Who do you see as your interlocutors in that kind of trying to hash that out?
Well, Archbishop Chaput is a leading one. I mean, one of the things I admire so much about him is his realism. He's a hopeful man, but he's not optimistic. He's more optimistic than I am, but what I would draw the distinction between optimism and hope. Optimism is the belief that everything's going to get better. That's not the same thing as Christian hope. Christian hope is the assurance that even if we're called to suffer, that if we unite our suffering to Christ, it's going to matter. It's going to mean something. I think there's every reason to hope, but not a lot of reasons to be optimistic in the short term. And I think that's really something, Si, that we Americans struggle with. We're very optimistic, future-oriented people,
yeah.
And we don't like to think about defeat. And that's where I think some readers of this book are people who contend with this idea. It does seem like defeat to them. It seems like I'm just throwing in the towel in the culture war. What I would say is it's not so much throwing in the towel as realizing that the nature of the war has changed and we have to go underground and be the resistance, if I can use that metaphor. We have got to learn how to deal with the world as it is realistically, not the world of 1950s Catholicism or the world of the past that is just not going to come back. And we have to, this is why I bring up the Benedictines. They arose after the fall of the Roman Empire. Everything had fallen apart in Western Europe then. Western Europe had not been fully Christianized at all. And what they asked, what they sought to do was to figure out how can we live faithful lives under these circumstances. St. Benedict did not go out to the woods from the ruins of Rome and say, aha, here, I'm going to come up with a plan to save Western civilization. All he wanted to do was to establish what he called a school for the service of the Lord, to be faithful right there where he was. It was after his death that his ideas really caught on and his movement spread throughout Western Europe, slowly evangelizing people, teaching people to pray, educating people, and eventually laying the groundwork for the rebirth of civilization. We have to hope that that will be in God's plan for the United States and for the West in the future, but that's not up to us to control what happens hundreds of years from now. What we have to do is hold on to the faith and spread the faith right here, right now. And that requires taking a long, hard look at where the broader culture is and where we fit into it. And as Archbishop Chaput writes, we are strangers in a strange land now. This used to be, you could say this was our country at some point in the sense that this was a Christian country, a country that was not without problems. There's never been a utopia since Eden, but it was a country that understood itself according to the Christian story. Those days are gone now, and they're not coming back anytime soon. This is no reason to despair, but it is a reason to change our way of living to deal with the country and to deal with the society as it really is. Because if we're trying to operate according to some idea that, oh, if we just elect the right people, put the right judges in place, everything's going to be okay, we are going to lose and lose badly. In fact, we already are.
Indeed. A critique there, however, Rod. So if some will say, as a matter of fact, I have heard this said, well, if we do this kind of withdrawal into smaller communities, more intense communities, for the purpose of forming ourselves, for forming our families, reintroducing people to the gospel in a world that's lost the gospel. One of the consequences of the modern world's loss of Christ, I would say to you, is injustice. And so we live in a world that is becoming cruel almost to a shocking degree with, you know, as you said, the destruction of gender, enormous injustice to children being done there. Children in the womb under constant attack, the elderly and the disabled increasingly under attack. So is there a way in which we don't have the luxury of devoting ourselves to kind of strategic retreat or something in the face of this massive injustice that there's a kind of demand implicit in the modern world for us to say no?
Yeah. I'm really glad you asked me that because I don't think that the Benedict option is properly construed as an either or, but rather a both and a readjustment of the way we order our devotion. Let me explain what I mean there. You're right. We have got to stay involved in mainstream politics to fight for the right to life for the unborn, to fight against euthanasia, to fight for religious liberty, and all these things are absolutely important. And I write about that in the book. However, I think about a case that that occurred to me, gosh, maybe about 2005, when I was working at the Dallas Morning News and on the editorial board, and people were talking about same-sex marriage back then. This is when it first became a real big national issue. And we on the editorial board had to figure out, you know, what stand are we going to take? Well, I was arguing back then in the hallway with a fellow Catholic who worked on the editorial board, a really good guy, a Republican, conservative, masculine Catholic. And I was talking to him about what the Catholic Church teaches about marriage and the nature of sex and sexuality. And he didn't agree with me at all. He was for gay marriage. And I kept trying to come at him from different angles to say, but, you know, the church teaches da-da-da-da. He didn't care. He's not a bad guy, but he just said, well, I don't believe that. I said, but you're Catholic. You know, this catechism, I had a catechism in my hand. The catechism tells us what the church teaches, and as Catholics, we are obliged to form our consciences by this. He just didn't see it. And we had no common basis for arguing. And we were, mind you, two Catholics, two white, middle-aged Republican Catholics. What I would like, the lesson I want to take from that for your listeners is that when you can't even get Catholics to agree on something as elemental as the meaning of marriage, we're in real trouble. How can we provide any kind of united witness to the culture when so many of us have been absorbed by it and have allowed it to catechize us, not the magisterium of the church? This is what Catholic Answers exist to do, is to catechize the faithful. And we, you know, I think we have to be active in the public square, certainly, but when we don't even have our own troops behind us, so to speak, it's very hard to wage a culture war.
Indeed. Yeah. Now, what about, Rod, you know, I have to tell you, you sound like a Catholic. you talk about Pope Benedict, you visit these Catholic communities and call them ideal, but you are, worship in the Eastern Orthodox. You're a member of the Eastern Orthodox community. I'm trying not to hold that against you, Rod. I wonder if you can explain that a little bit. Like you sound deeply Catholic, I'm not trying to exaggerate the differences between Eastern Orthodoxy and all that. But why are you over there?
Well, as I said, I was a very committed Catholic for 13 years, but I lost my faith after 3 years of intense struggle writing as a journalist about the abuse scandal in the early 2000s. And God, in his mercy, rescued me after my Catholic faith was shattered, and I could have lost my faith entirely, but he rescued me through the Eastern Orthodox Church. And losing my Catholic faith was the most painful thing that ever happened to me. And I say that as somebody who has buried in the last 5 years his father and his sister. But it was the center of my life. But here's what I did wrong as a Catholic. I thought for so many years that as long as I had my faith in my head, as long as I had the reasons, the syllogisms, the arguments, the apologetics straight in my head, that my faith could withstand anything. But it was not true. I was intellectually arrogant in that. And when I was confronted with some of the hideous things that I learned covering the scandal, things that I wasn't even able to write in public because I couldn't get people to go on the record, but I knew they were true, I couldn't deal with it. Even though I had faithful Catholic friends who were every bit as outraged as I was, it just tore me to bits. I realized in retrospect that there was a time when I came into I was coming into the Catholic Church in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, going to for instruction, and somebody at my office said, "Oh, I hear you're going to be a Catholic. Well, why don't you come work with me at Mother Teresa's Soup Kitchen downtown, the Missionaries of Charity Soup Kitchen?" I said, "Okay, I'll go do that. That sounds like a very Catholic thing to do." I went there, spent an afternoon scrubbing pots and peeling potatoes, and never went back. I thought to myself, "Well, that's great for some people, but I'm more of an intellectual. I would better spend my time reading books of theology." Well, 13 years later, with my Catholic faith in ruins, I realized that if I spent at least as much time down at the soup kitchen doing something like that, working with my hands, training my heart, rooting my heart in the faith, not just my head, but my heart, I might have had the resilience to withstand this terrible challenge to my faith. Well, it's not a mistake I'm going to make as an Orthodox Christian. I resolved in it. I'm also not going to idolize the church. I idolize the Catholic Church so much. And this is a mistake that a lot of my Catholic friends who are cradle Catholics did not make, but I made it as a convert. As an Orthodox Christian, I'm not going to idolize the church, but I have paid a lot more attention to the ordinary, everyday practices of forming my conscience, not just my head, but forming my heart through the practice of prayer. It's something that's available to all Catholics, too, but a lot of converts like I was and a lot of more intellectually oriented Catholics, we think that we're forming our consciences when, in fact, we're just sharpening our arguments. These arguments are important to sharpen, don't get me wrong, but as the Benedictine life shows, there's no substitute for everyday, ordinary fidelity in prayer, in scripture reading, and in ordering everyday life, plain life, to Christ. And that's one thing I want to tell your Catholic listeners. I love the Catholic Church. I've written a book in honoring these wonderful monks in Norcia who are a light to the world, even to we who are outside the Roman Catholic Church. But there's no don't be arrogant like I was. Don't say, aha, we have the fullness of the faith and we have the best arguments and that's all we need. You need to form your hearts as well.
And one of the criticisms then of modern orthodoxy, Rod, is that there's this tendency to become national churches. And so I want to just ask you about that. And I suppose it's also sometimes that same critique is leveled against evangelical Protestantism, the tendency to become a patriotic church. And so I want to ask you about the withdrawal or creating a space between ourselves and the popular culture, but also creating a space in which we, across, whether we are Catholic, evangelical, other or Orthodox, between ourselves and nation states, you know, being not just being patriotic churches, and a space where we love one another across these divides.
Yeah, this is so important. In Orthodoxy, that nationalism is a besetting sin. It's been condemned by the Orthodox bishops as a heresy called philotism. There's nothing wrong with loving your own people and your own nation, but the nation is not the same thing as the church. You know, we can Right. make an idol of a nation so easily. This is why one of the reasons I agree with St. John Paul when he talked about the church needing to breathe with both of its lungs, east
right.
and west. The east has maintained, if I may say so, far more reverent liturgy and style of prayer, more ancient style of prayer. And I think that's something, you know, Eastern liturgy and Eastern devotions are something that the Western church can really learn from. And in fact, you have it in Eastern Rite Catholicism. That said, we in the east, in the Christian east, can learn more about small C Catholicism from the Latin Church. In other words, how to be not so bound to the nation, but to be more universal. I do think, though, that we started out talking about my designation of small O Orthodox Christians, that is, Catholics, yeah. Eastern Orthodox, and Protestants who share something in common. And the thing that we share in common, and we have to hold on to, even as we hold on to our doctrinal distinctives, is this idea that truth is outside of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So many times in my life as a Catholic, and it's just continued as an Eastern Orthodox, I would find I had more in common with certain evangelicals than I did with people in my own church. And the reason is because we believed that the truth existed outside of us, and God was calling us to get over ourselves and to convert and to conform our lives to his will, whereas more liberal people within the different churches believe that religion is something that we can adjust to suit ourselves and to suit the times. This is where I think the commonality comes in among Christians of different confessions. And I really like the phrase that either Chuck Colson or Father Newhouse invented, called the ecumenism of the trenches. This is how Catholics and evangelicals got to know each other better in the front lines in front of abortion clinics back in the 80s and 90s. It came to realize that even though there are some very important differences between them, the differences that can't be easily overlooked, nevertheless, there is a real Christian brotherhood there and a real opportunities for all of us to work together on issues of common concern. I think that is absolutely the truth with the Benedict option. And I'm proud to say that I've gotten to know so many evangelicals in doing this work and come to realize, as someone who has never been evangelical, how many friends we have, we who are from the older traditions, have among evangelicals, men and women who are struggling, fighting the same fights we are within their own churches and who can benefit from some of our wisdom too.
Right. And how important to the Benedict option is that local parish, whether it's an Orthodox parish or a Protestant church or a Catholic parish? How important is there a role in revitalizing these institutions? It seems to me, in a certain sense, we have this given of that all these local institutions, they're hyper-local, really. And I wonder, it's a given, but it's not always a given that flourishes. What's their role in the Benedict option?
Well, you know, when I came into the Catholic Church, it was as an unmarried man, and I realized very quickly that there was a lot of distance between the Church of John Paul II far away in Rome, the Church of Father Richard John Newhouse, and the parish down the street. It was not something I was prepared for. And when you have kids, you begin to realize how much more important it is to have a strong local parish. And for a variety of reasons, a lot of Catholics, and not just Catholics, don't have that. But that doesn't excuse us for sitting back and lamenting what we don't have. I look at the Tipolowski, again, my Italian Catholic friends, and realize these are people who go to ordinary Catholic parishes there in their town, but they have this sort of movement. It's not a movement out like Communion and Liberation outside of their town. It's just their own local thing. But they use that to supplement their sacramental life in the parish. And I think that we need to come together in our parishes. That's where the sacraments are. We can never be against the church. But we have to try to revitalize the church from within the parishes. But if that doesn't work, or if for whatever reason we find opposition from the pastor or others, that doesn't mean that we can just stop there. Ideally, this would be welcomed in parishes, and the local parish should be the ark, the local lifeboat of the bark of Peter right there in your town. But if it's not, that doesn't, then we just have to be creative and find ways around that.
A book is The Benedict Option, highly recommended. It's a part of a great conversation that seems to be just starting at this moment, of a conversation about what to do now, really, and that now being now that we truly are stuck with this post-Christian world. That is, it's not the tide is not receding, the storm is not passing. In fact, it is intensifying. You, in your travels, you said you went, you know, you go there to see the Benedictine monks. Benedict is called Benedict of Nursia. The town now is called Norcia. And you were mentioning to me before we did the interview that the monks, they suffered in an earthquake a few years ago and may be in need of help there.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story. I went there to see their monastery a year ago, and it's flourishing. They have 16 monks there, most of them Americans. They're young, they're traditional, they're a beacon of light. But last October, an earthquake in Italy, the strongest one in 30 years, was centered just north of Norcia. It knocked down their basilica, their medieval basilica, left it in ruins, and most of their monastery in ruins. Because those monks, though, had heeded the signs that came from earlier tremors in late summer, they had moved outside of the city walls and set up tents on the hillside overlooking the little town of Norcia and to continue their monastic life. Their lives were saved because they read the signs of the times and got out of the way of it. They look down at the ruins of their basilica and monastery and see in that a symbol of the church in the West today. They don't despair over it, but because they had lived this life of prayer, constant prayer and order, according to the Benedictine rule, they have the resilience in their hearts to go back and rebuild. And they believe that this is what God is calling us all to do now, take stock of the mess that is Christianity in the West today, not to despair over it, but to recommit ourselves to living lives of holiness, lives of order, and beginning the slow, patient work of rebuilding. Father Cassian Folsom, who was the prior of the Norcia Monastery until the earthquake, he retired. But he told me, when I told him about the Benedict option, he said, well, let me be the first one to tell you that Christian families who do not do some form of the Benedict option, they're not going to make it through the trials ahead. So this was him telling me that some version of the Benedict option has to be adopted, not just by Catholic families, but by Christian families everywhere, because the times are not like normal times. We're facing a trial unlike any other in the history of the church. God has given us everything we need to not only resist this, but to flourish in the middle of it. But we have to respond to it. I asked Marco Sermarini of the Tipolowski, how do you do this? You're living out the dream of what so many of us Christians want. What's your secret? He said, we have no secrets. This was here preserved for us all along, this wisdom of the church. We had locked it away in an old box and forgotten about it. We just opened the box and rediscovered it. That is the secret right there. It's already here in front of us in the Eucharist, in the teachings of the Church, in the practices of the Benedictines and of our fathers and mothers in the faith. We just need to open our eyes to what's there and celebrate it and bring it into our lives.
Rod Dreher, author of The Benedict Option, a book that will be continue to be much talked about for a long time, I am sure. You're very gracious to spend so much time with us. Thanks for being with us today, Rod Dreher.
Oh, it's a pleasure. We need each other all going forward, and I'm honored to walk with Archbishop Chaput and all my Catholic brothers and sisters in building up this future for ourselves.
Amen, brother. Thank you very much. Rod Dreher, The Benedict Option is the book. You can find it, well, to be honest, everywhere. This is Cy Kellett. This is Catholic Answers Focus. Thanks for being with us this week. We'll see you again next Friday.